Blog Talk Radio.
United, how you doing? It's good to be with you guys tonight. Jerry, what's going on?
What's up? What's going on?
Not a lot. Not a lot. Got a great show for you tonight. Director Bruce Beresford, who has made more than a few movies that have really captivated the audiences and kind of cemented their place in cinema history.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. Would you consider him part of that Australian New Wave that came about?
Yes.
Like,
yes.
Like Breaker Morant and Mr. Johnson and all those great movies. And yeah, I mean, I love Breaker Morant. It's a wonderful movie.
Yeah, he is considered part of that group with Peter Weir and, you know.
George Miller and I guess, I guess Roger Donaldson, Smash Palace and those sort of things. So yeah, I mean, that was a great moment. In movies, the Australians are making a lot of great, they still are making great films. There's a new crime movie, an Australian crime movie called Animal Kingdom that looks incredible.
Yeah.
We have John Hillcoat made The Proposition in the Road. So, I mean, there's a lot of great stuff coming out of there. There always is.
Yeah, yeah. Oddly enough, though, the one movie that's not so great from Australia is called Australia.
Yeah, I'm the only person that likes that one. But
no, I actually, I think it's fine.
But you know who don't? You know the Australians don't like it. We have a lot of Australian friends, and they just think it's horrible.
Mm.
Like my brother, I was like friends. One of his friends is Australian. They hate it down there. They really do not like that movie.
But Bruce Beresford, Breaker Morant, of course, Tender Mercies, and Driving Miss Daisy are his two biggies. Crimes of the Heart, Paradise Road, A Good Man in Africa.
Yes.
Double Jeopardy.
Double Jeopardy, that's right. That's the one with Ashley Judd, right? And Tommy Lee Jones?
Yes.
Okay, all right.
So we will welcome him on the show in just a bit. Have you seen anything new
Well, I haven't
recently?
Seen anything new. I watched some of Rescue Me last night, but I took my brother to see Scott Pilgrim, so I went and saw it again last night. And I think anybody who could read my mind knew that was going to come eventually, a second viewing. And I loved it even more a second time. If that's possible, because I really loved it the first time. But it's just a really clever little movie. And I will tell you, though, the Monday morning quarterbacking, everyone looking for excuses why it didn't do well. I think it did well, and I think it's going to join like films like Fight Club and Office Space and have a very long shelf life in pop culture history and everything. But I think people are discovering it. It was very crowded last night at our theater, and
right.
I actually think good word of mouth is going to help this film, but people are just making excuses for it Monday morning, like, oh, you know, people don't like Michael Cera and that, and I'll be the first to say I think Michael Cera sort of dug himself into a hole before Youth and Revolt, and I think that movie sort of dug him out a little bit, and this one, I'll make an argument that he's playing against type. I mean, Scott Pilgrim is not a nice guy. I mean, he's really kind of despicable throughout most of the film, his actions and everything. But, you know, so I think that's good. But the whole cast is good. Just I think what Chris said the other night, just having even smallest performances are just spot on. And there's just a lot of nice visuals, and Edgar Wright's direction just gets better and better with each film. And the soundtrack is beautiful. And it's just a really good film all around.
Yeah. Here's a quote from M. Night Shyamalan. Sorry.
That sounds That was great. I love that segue.
I know. I was listening to what you were saying. I was just, I didn't know what segue to use here.
Yeah, okay.
Here's what he says. I don't know what's going on with me and the critics in the United States. I've always had a European sensibility to my movies, so the pacing is always a little bit off for Americans. I'm very used to getting on a plane from the U.S. having been savaged by them and going to Japan next, and then they're like, genius! So is it just something that we don't get as an American culture?
It's
Which,
not-
by the way, if there's one thing that America should be proud of,
mm-hmm.
the one thing that is America is, without a doubt, the most successfully American product, the most successful American product. I can't talk tonight. It's cinema.
Right.
Everybody internationally reveres American cinema. It,
mm-hmm.
it has forever been one of our great, if not the greatest export we have.
Right. Like The Village, I've gone back and watched again, and I like more. You know, even when you get the trick ending and all that stuff out of the way, it's actually an interesting film. Lady in the Water, not so much, and I think The Happening is just kind of laughable. I haven't seen The Last Airbender, so I don't know, but I just think he's going to make something eventually, maybe, where people will come back. And if he gets rid of the gimmicks, I think, and everything, and goes back and tries to make a real movie, he might, you know, win some followers. But I like The Sixth Sense, and I like Unbreakable. I think he should work with Bruce Willis personally, but, you know, it gets old after a while, I guess.
Yeah, and see, I like The Sixth Sense, and I like Signs.
No, Signs, too. I do like Signs. With a baseball bat at the end or whatever, I'm not sure.
Swing away. you know, and I, for some reason, I've seen Unbreakable several times, and I've tried to give it another chance, and
mm-hmm.
it doesn't hit me. I mean, I don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's because I've never been a lifelong fan of comics, but I understand the themes and the mythology and all that kind of stuff. It's not a lack of understanding. It's just a lack of enthusiasm I have about that movie.
Right. No, I understand that. I mean, you know, to each their own. I mean, it's like not, you know, if you don't like comics, I could definitely say if you don't like the subject matter, it's going to be, you know, hard for you to get into it. I mean, Unbreakable wasn't even the same league a hit as The Sixth Sense when it came out. So it did well, but not, it didn't have the success of The Sixth Sense. So, I mean, you're not alone in that thing. I think Unbreakable is probably my favorite of the ones I do like by him, but it's, you know, it's not for everybody, you know.
Mm-hmm. Here's an interesting topic. Psycho being released on Blu-ray
mm-hmm.
Because it's been 50 years. And there's controversy in some of these older films when they upgrade it and they clean it up for Blu-ray, obviously.
Right.
And they remove the grain. And certain purists see the grain as like an essential part of, you know, the movie.
Right.
The movie experience. It's like, I don't know, are we at a point where are those the same kind of people that think that vinyl sounds better than CD? You know, is it that kind of argument? Is it a non-argument, or is there something to it?
That's a good analogy. Look, there are people. I mean, vinyl disappeared for a long time, and then not disappeared, but it's come back. You can buy vinyl again. Certain, you know, Merge Records, I think, releases everything in vinyl now, along with CDs. And look, I'm old-fashioned because I'd rather get CDs and download it off iTunes. And, you know, who would have thought? But that's everyone's like doing the digital thing, and I do like that sometimes, but. That's a good analogy, though. That's an interesting analogy. I don't know. I mean, I like what our good friend Kitten Fist said in the chat room, though. That's what I like. I just love what he just wrote. Beautiful.
Yeah.
That was beautiful. Thank you.
They're called a-holes. They're called a-holes.
That was just beautiful.
I don't know that it bothers me to see a cleaned up Psycho. I mean,
I can't get worked up about it. I really can't.
Can't, because Cameron just did an interview and he said that they have done the Blu-ray of Aliens,
mm-hmm.
and he shot it on a film stock that was obsolete the next year. It was a new film stock, and it went. It was discontinued the following year, and so there was a lot of grain and stuff. They said they took out all the grain, and it's cleaned up, and it looks better than it did when it played at the theater.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there's certain movies, you know, and then certain movies are shot in, you know, shot a certain way, like McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't want that kind of hazy, cloudy, hallucinogenic type look taken out of that movie. You wouldn't want that cleaned up.
No, no, you
necessarily.
Wouldn't. No.
So I guess it has to be very specific on a very specific kind of movie-to-movie basis.
Yeah, I think so. But look, there's someone like George Lucas who obviously wants to clean up everything. He'd like to go back and keep going back and erasing things and cleaning up things. He would have, if he could, probably shoot it with all computer images and no actors. I mean.
Yeah, he'd give Han Solo a modern haircut.
Yeah, he'd give everyone. I mean, it's amazing. When he did those special editions, I wasn't really aware of it at the time until maybe a year later. He would have gone back and changed everything, I think, if he had, he does have unlimited money, but I think he would have changed the whole damn thing.
Which I think we upset one of our loyal listeners because they left a posting on our Facebook that said you guys should do a Star Wars tribute show, seeing how you and your friends all hate it so much.
No, we don't hate it. Actually, I'm probably one of its, of the three of us, probably its greatest fan, but we don't hate it. Not at all.
I wrote back and I said, and she's great. She's always so supportive of our show, so she wasn't saying anything kind of backhanded.
Right.
I don't think. But I wrote back and I said, we all love the original films. We're not big fans of the more recent films. But what we hate is Lucas's obvious disdain for the original films and the way he bleeds his fans dry.
Yeah, it's getting to her. I think it's ridiculous.
So that was a fair response?
Oh, yeah, it is.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sorry to talk over you.
No, I just want to make sure that we're all online, because when I speak, I speak for Movie Geeks United, and
right,
it's more
right.
than me. It's all of us.
No, that's cool, yeah. No, you're right, though. But I want to add something to that, too, though, even maybe greater. While I am, it's, for growing up and everything, while those movies were, between the first three movies and for probably like 6 years of my life, that was really a big deal. I noticed with these recent prequels, and I thought things would slow down after the last one came out, that was 5 years ago, and he's just really, there are more books now out in comics than there were even during all the prequels, even in between prequels, and you just want to say, do you want to just give it a rest?
The terrible animated movie, the Clone Wars thing that came out, they got the television series and stuff. I mean, I don't mind necessarily through these movies introducing it to a new generation, but
right. Come
on, is the Clone Wars really, is that up to snuff with the original trilogy?
No, it's not. And it's not even, and this is another thing, and then we can drop this conversation, I'm sorry to have carried it for so long, is that after everything we had heard, and I guess everything that we had built up in our own imaginations about the Clone Wars, you really think about the scale and scope of things, well, really it wasn't all that, It wasn't this, I don't know, that's just a personal thing, but it just, for some reason, it wasn't as mythic, I guess, or...
Well, you alluded to it last show, and we didn't expand upon it, but I read that interview that you were talking about with Gary Kurtz,
yeah, mm-hmm.
Where he said that Return of the Jedi was originally to be much darker, have kind of a darker kind of ending,
mm-hmm.
and Lucas changed it because he was worried about toy sales.
Yeah, that wasn't even his original answer about Lucas's original answer, because this is talking about Han Solo was going to be killed, and it was something Harrison Ford wanted too.
Yeah,
and Lucas's original explanation, if you hear it from him, is I always was very, I cried whenever a good guy was killed in a movie I watched when I was growing up. No, this really was all about toy sales. Everything was
right about.
He became a businessman. He never wanted to be a businessman, but he became one. And you know.
Yeah, when the toy sales and those exceeded the income that they got from the movies, believe
mm-hmm.
it or not, when those when that runs the content of whatever film you're making, I mean, there's something wrong. There's something very Leonard Part 6 about that, where Bill Cosby will give a monologue holding a can of Coke perfectly in frame with the camera. You know, there's...
Yeah, no, I mean...
was that an obscure reference? I'm sorry.
But it's you know, it really starts really back, I guess, in between Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, really, is where this all starts. And I don't... Yeah, whatever. You know,
did you see something else? Did you see the Black Swan trailer?
Oh yes, I did. When does that come out?
It's the new Aronofsky. I guess it's a holiday movie. I know it's premiering at the New York Film Festival.
Should I start camping out now?
Yeah, I mean, it looks like something else. It looks like a real strong role for her, for Natalie Portman, certainly. And speaking of strong performances for women, they're saying that Anne Hathaway is a shoe-in for a nomination for the Love and Other Drugs movie?
Really? Okay. I finally saw that trailer last week. Yeah, I definitely. I guess it takes place during the 90s and stuff, but it looks like a really. It looks very interesting, I think, so.
Yeah, I thought it would be more unique looking than it looked like from the trailer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to describe it. It just looks kind of. It looks like the James L. Brooks trailer. It looks like another kind of romantic comedy. She's
a
free spirit.
You could interchange them and not notice anything?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't know who's directed Life and Other Drugs or Love and
Other
Drugs.
I have no idea either.
Oh, but you know what? Well, you know what's getting raves? Advanced screenings of the movie Stone, which is a movie Robert De Niro, Edward Norton, and Mila Jovovich.
Oh, yeah, right? Yeah.
You see the trailer for it, and it's like Edward Norton in prison, his girlfriend... seduces Robert De Niro, who I think is a parole officer,
mm-hmm.
into busting him out or something, and you think you know what it is, but apparently this reviewer, Jeffrey Wells at Hollywood Elsewhere, said this movie goes in a completely different direction than you expect, for all the characters turn out
mm-hmm.
to be something surprising, and everybody does their best work, De Niro's best work in years,
mm-hmm.
and he says it's one of the great movies of the past years. Few years.
Wow, okay. Cool. Looking forward
yeah,
to it.
Yeah, yeah. And this is a guy that doesn't mince words, Jeffrey Wells. He's pretty,
no, he doesn't.
He doesn't mind expressing pessimism about a film. Yeah. So let's bring Dean on the line.
Yes.
All right. Hey, Dean.
Hey.
Hi, Dean.
Hey.
Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I don't
yes,
hear any cop cars.
Good. I'm calling from my apartment, and I got my head out the window. So, Black Swan. What'd you guys think of that trailer?
Oh, I think can I go watch it again while you guys talk about it?
No, I mean you thought it was good because I really thought that that it had a lot of things that I'd seen before in it, and I don't blame that on the filmmaker because I know how trailer producers work, and I know how they kind of tend to focus in on things that they've already seen as beats for
mm-hmm.
for the
right.
trailers. So I can't tell whether it's going to be a good movie or a bad movie yet.
Well,
do you think it's Aronofsky's? Do you think it's Aronofsky's Showgirls? Is that what you're saying?
I really don't know. I can't tell. You know, I mean, like I'm thinking it might be Aronofsky's Single White Female.
That's he's right. That's what it reminds me of the most. Single White Female. I was thinking the exact same thing. But
I mean,
this. Trailers
yeah.
suck. For the
they
most
do.
Part.
They
really
they
do.
I've been in editing rooms with trailer producers for television.
Right.
And I know what they do, and I know how much control they have over everything, too. Sometimes they leave a lot of control up to the editors themselves, and they let the editors, the people who are at the board,
mm-hmm.
find the beats that they think would work best as a part of a trailer.
Yeah.
And so trailers don't actually come from the director's mind. I mean, this
no, not at all.
To me, like the Social Network trailer is something that screams out that was controlled by Fincher himself.
Yeah. But let's talk about the obvious. The two trailers that I think didn't make the sale after watching the films are Kick-Ass and Scott Pilgrim. I mean, the people who made those trailers, whoever was finally in charge of those, they really did a bad job of selling the film or getting. I mean, Scott Pilgrim almost focuses on the obvious things of the film, but not its most interesting aspects of the film. The same, I think, could go for Kick-Ass to an extent. Even Youth and Revolt, for that matter. I think you're right. Maybe the filmmaker does. Obviously, someone very bright is doing the Social Network trailer. That's a great trailer. I would have to say it's my favorite trailer this year.
I mean, come on. There's nothing that even comes close to it.
Yeah.
Really.
No.
But I do think this is the part, this is like the thing where you have to hook the core audience. The trailer is the thing that has to get the outside, the people who normally would not go see this film. It's there to hook the outsider.
And that's where Scott Pilgrim and Kick-Ass failed. Is that what
they
you're
did.
Saying?
They didn't cross over.
I agree.
Oh, now, there's a trailer I like for a movie that probably won't be any good, but I do like the trailer for Wall Street 2. I know a lot of people don't, but I do like
it.
I see.
Yeah.
I'm in the minority, but I actually think it's a very good trailer.
I think it screams out a remake of the first film with all of the faults of the first film and probably none of the strengths, unfortunately.
Okay, that's fair. I just think it grips me. I guess maybe because of the Stone song or whatever, but you know.
I can't. That's a thing that brings me out of it because that song has been overused.
Right.
That's a song.
Okay.
That's a song that belongs on the jukebox from hell. That's the song. I mean, that's the song that look, like, I'll give you another song that belongs on the jukebox from hell. I Feel Good by James Brown. You know, you don't want to hear that on any other trailer ever again.
Wait, are you saying that when I go to hell, these songs will be playing?
Yes.
I feel good will be playing when you're in hell?
Really?
They will be. You'll be like, fuck, I can't take this song anymore, or whatever.
How about the most overused music cues in movies, like Hallelujah is like a big one.
That's on the jukebox from hell, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you have this info, Dean, and where can I get this list that you're looking at?
I don't know. It's in my head. But Born to Be Wild is on the jukebox from hell. So
Bad to the Bone, anytime.
Is on the jukebox from hell. Respect by Aretha Franklin. My Girl by The Temptations. These are all jukebox from hell things where you're like, fuck, I can't listen to this song anymore. It's like, I can't listen to it again.
Right. Okay, you know, I hear you. There are several songs like that. I mean,
yeah.
So tell me examples. Obviously, The Social Network is the best of the recent trailers. Tell me examples of great trailers.
Well, of course, the greatest trailer that's ever been made is probably Psycho, the 6-minute trailer that was done by Alfred Hitchcock. That was, a great trailer is something that provides something that the movie itself cannot provide. So this brings Psycho into the number one position because it's the one trailer that actually becomes a movie unto itself. And, in fact, in New York City soon, they're going to have a William Castle retrospective where they're going to have all of the gimmicks that William Castle had, like Percepto and Emergo and all those things. And they're going to show one of the features is they're going to show a print of the 6-minute trailer for Psycho. on one of those. I don't know why, but they're just going to show it because it's not connected with William Castle, but they're going to show it. And anyway, that just shows you that this is a movie unto itself. So it's the greatest trailer ever. I would throw in some other good trailers like, Alfred Hitchcock's Frenzy, which is also sort of a callback to Psycho.
Mm-hmm.
I would throw in Coppola's Rumblefish as one of the greatest trailers. Also, Pablo Ferro's trailer for Dr. Strangelove is pretty incredible. The trailer for Kentucky Fried Movie is pretty terrific. Also, the one for Bob Fosse's All That Jazz is great. There's a lot of good trailers. You know, there are a lot of good trailers, but they're few and far between these days because there are so many tricks. I've seen it done again. I've seen it done in the editing room. There's so many tricks that are already programmed into the editing boards now. You know, those booms and those flash frames of white that go back down and stuff like that. All those things are like already programmed in. They're very easy for the editors to put in there. So all of those things are just automatic go-tos for the editors now. And there's no real like building up from the bottom to the top on trailers, you know, anymore.
Here's my favorite trailer, or one of my favorite trailers. Polanski. No, I'm not playing it. I'm going to tell you.
Too bad.
Polanski's The Tenant.
Oh wow, I haven't seen that one.
Yeah.
Well, it's just like your poster. It the narration on it is exactly what's written on the poster. That whole spiel.
Oh wow.
And
man.
It's just a tracking shot through the apartment to the open door where Polanski's standing, and it ends on his face. Nobody does it to you like Polanski, and then it ends.
What Jamie's talking about there is I have on my blog, which is filmicability.blogspot.com, I have a ongoing series of that showcases my poster collection.
That's quite a poster collection you have, by the way.
It's only about 600 titles, but
it's only 600? I mean, that's a lot, man.
It's only about 600 titles. The first 560 will be done from Z to A, and when you look at them, they'll be A to Z on the site. I'm working on the M titles right now, which there's a lot of M movies, surprisingly. And then the very last thing will be the 40 posters that are of my collection that I actually have to photograph, which are either signed by people, important people, or are so rare that I could not find one image of them on the web. Because I wasn't gonna like roll out all these posters and photograph each one of them. Fuck that. I'm not gonna do that.
Actually, you mentioned something, the M titles. Another one of my favorite posters is M, but not the theatrical version or the reprints. It's the Criterion box cover, that exact image that I wish I could find in a poster form. They have something similar, but it's a different look, and it's a different M on the guy's back. And
actually, if Criterion was smart, they would release all of their images for each one of their movies that they release as poster art, because honestly, that's probably the best poster art that's being done right now. I mean, it's not posters, but they are advertising art, and they are incredible.
Yeah, no,
I agree with you. And there's this really strange cover they have for their Thin Red Line that is coming out with.
Yeah, I saw that. I love it.
It's like a book or a magazine. You could actually see the fold in it on the cover.
Yeah, it's great. It's great because it actually harks back to James Jones's, literary reputation in a lot of ways. And
yeah.
So that's great. I just love their stuff. They are, you know, TCM, Turner Classic Movies, previous to Criterion, was to me the king of any kind of movie-related graphics.
Right.
I mean, like everything that TCM did, and I was working there at the time. I was working at TNT from Turner Network Television from 94 to 98, mid 98, and there I realized that TCM was even then, like from that whole time, TCM was doing the most amazing movie-related graphics that you could possibly imagine, and they're still doing it. You just go onto their website. Their website's incredible. I have a couple of friends that write for Movie Morlocks, which is an incredible, beautiful website, and the look of TCM is terrific, but I think Criterion has actually surpassed it in terms of diversity and creativity.
Well, here's the other kind of releases coming out from Criterion, and then we'll take this other phone call. 323, I got you on the line. I'll get you in just 1 second. They got Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, in September.
Mm-hmm.
They got The Thin Red Line in September. Paths of Glory in October.
Wow. Is that their first Kubrick? I think that's their first Kubrick.
I think it might very well be. I think it could be.
Yeah, it is.
They need to do Barry Lyndon, but maybe they don't have the. But they have a whole big problem with rights and that kind of thing, and what studio and what.
That's what they fight. That's their job. They're fighting against all of that stuff.
Yeah, the Darjeeling Limited.
I will get that.
Limited. October. Here's the most exciting right here. Here's what excites me. November 16th, The Night of the Hunter.
Yes.
Oh, my God. Are you kidding me?
One of the most beautifully photographed movies ever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a great movie. So I can't wait to see that. Antichrist, they're going to do that, of course.
I don't know that again.
Is that their first Von Trier?
I thought they did Epidemic, or was it Scene of the Crime or something? Or
I don't think so, man. I think this might be their first. I think they might. This might be their first. I don't think so, because I was like, I worked at a video store recently, and I knew the whole Criterion collection. I don't think so.
Okay, no, I thought they might there. I could have sworn. Well, you might be right. I mean, I'll look it up, but I could have sworn there was
Modern Times also comes out in November. And here's something really exciting. They have a box set coming out December 14th.
Yeah, tell them about that.
America Lost and Found, the BBS story. Featuring the following special editions of these films. They're late 60s, early 70s films.
Oh, my God.
For the most part.
This is going to be incredible.
Drawing on that period. Each one has the extras that you expect from a Criterion release. Bob Raffleson's head.
No. Oh, my God.
Easy Rider. Raffleson's Five Easy Pieces. Nicholson's Drive, he said. Some of these available for the first time, you know.
That's a biggie right there.
There are two previous Lars von Trier's Criterion.
Okay. All right, cool.
The Element of Crime and Europa, which was released here as Zentropa.
Zentropa. All right. Fair enough.
Henry Jaglom's A Safe Place. Bogdanovich's Last Picture Show. And Raffleson's King of Marvin Gardens.
That is a hell of a box set. I mean, that is an incredible box set. I mean, you're really going to learn a lot about movies by looking at that box set. I'm telling you.
Yeah, and Raffleson's a director that's not spoken about enough, I don't think. And actually, we sent an email to him like back when we were thinking of doing a Nicholson tribute show, and. And he wrote back, and I guess he was busy with something else. But so we have reached out to him. That is an exciting. I've always wanted Criterion to do a Last Tango in Paris. Actually, when we had the Criterion person on, I asked them, could you release Last Tango? And she said, okay, I'll put it on the list. So,
well, you know, they got a lot of movies on the list, but can you imagine, to me, the most, a lot of those movies are great.
Yeah,
but
they are.
But for me, the one that's closest to my heart, truly, is Head. Head is
wow.
Seriously.
I'm sorry.
No. I'm seriously. When I was a film festival programmer in 2002, I wanted to do it was 2003. I wanted to do the 35th or 25th, whatever it is, anniversary showing of a 35mm print of Head. That was the one movie that was the first old movie that I wanted to show. I said, it's got to be Head. It's got to be that. It's great. It is so fantastic. Underrated. Ridiculously underrated. It is so fun and so weird and it's very smart too, you know.
It's great Head. I understand.
Well, I don't want to put it like that, but, you know.
People do complain about Criterion and them releasing, because the guys in the chat room mentioning the Michael Bay movies, and them releasing stuff like The Rock and Armageddon and that kind of thing. I really don't have a problem with that, because if it keeps them making money and income enough to do 95% of the other stuff that they release, that's fine by me.
I agree with that statement. You know,
thank you.
I agree
thank
with
you.
That statement totally. I mean, I'm not going to like stand in the way of them making some money, and I would actually encourage them to do the same thing with some other things, but be more careful about judiciously picking the things that they think might make money and the things that are great that might make money. I mean, why not put Aliens out? Or Alien and Aliens out, you know, that kind of thing. I mean,
I think they just happened upon Michael Bay probably approached them.
Yes, I understand that. I know what that's. Like.
And actually,
and
Armageddon, yeah, Wes Anderson. Which those are arty. I mean, no matter how much you like Wes Anderson, and I do like some of his movies. Those are still on the arty side.
Of course.
But with Michael Bay, that Armageddon Criterion is really entertaining. I mean, it's got great outtakes. It's got great commentary where people like Ben Affleck are on the commentary, and they're basically disparaging of the movie, you know, that they're in. And
really?
It's really entertaining to watch. Let's take this other call here. 323. It might be. Hang on.
Are they still there?
I'm trying to get my... Okay, 323, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hey.
Hey, what's
Donovan
up?
Donovan again.
Hey, Donovan, how are you?
What's up? Yeah,
Donovan.
I haven't spoken to Dean yet. I called in for the first time on Sunday, and I just spoke to Jerry and Jamie. So,
nice to meet you.
Yeah, no, I'm enjoying the Criterion conversation. I love Criterion. One point I was going to say was there has been a previous Kubrick film, that's Spartacus.
That's right.
Oh,
you're right. I have that. You're right. How stupid of me.
I mean, it's a Kubrick film that he disowned.
Yeah, of course.
Right.
I love that
it's
movie,
Kubrick
though. Okay.
But wrongly, I think. Wrongly.
Yeah.
Oh,
it's
definitely wrong.
It's like a director for hire, Kubrick.
Yes.
The original was Anthony Mann. The original?
Yeah,
right.
He did the opening scenes. He did the opening scenes across with all the slaves like working on the mountains of rock and stuff like that.
Right.
He did only those opening
right.
scenes. Yeah.
Yeah. He shot supposedly for like 5 days, and then. Kirk Douglas, because of his relationship with Kubrick on the previous film, Path of Glory, he hired Kubrick.
You know what? I'm waiting for the Criterion of Commando. Let me just say.
Who knows, man?
Cobra is my all-time pinnacle, great, cheesy action flick. But Commando is pretty much just neck and neck right below it. I rewatched it tonight. Man, that movie's a great time. I have such a better time watching that movie than anything from Ingmar Bergman. Like, which that should be obvious, because you know.
I had a great time watching Fanny and I and Fender because my first girlfriend was next to me.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I have nowhere to go with that. Apparently, you didn't either.
Top Gun. No, I had some place to go. Top Gun. You know what that means.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
Let me ask you guys a question. Roundtable, what is your most prized Criterion DVD in your collection?
Mm. Oh God, I don't know.
I have one. You want me to start? Now let those guys.
Oh God, we'll be here all night.
Yeah.
Well, no. I won't make it long. But
just give us two.
To tell you the truth, I really don't own a lot of DVDs because I don't believe in owning DVDs because I like to like be separated from the movies that I love because it makes me love them more when I go back to them. So, therefore, my only DVD that I own by Criterion is The Honeymoon Killers by Leonard Castle. I had to buy it the moment that I saw it. The moment that I saw the cover of it, I couldn't believe it. I had to get it. And that's the only Criterion movie that I own.
That's what Jackie Gleason, right?
It's a fancy, huh?
Jackie Gleason stars in that?
No. The Honeymoon Killers. you goddamn.
That's yeah. funny, man.
All right, that
is.
Is funny.
That is funny.
That is funny. You fooled me
I'll,
there.
I'll
too.
Tell you mine. But, I'll give you mine. Mine is Sam Peckinpah's Straw Dogs. It's out of print.
Yeah, I know.
Right,
I wanted. I hope they'll reissue that one day.
Yeah, I have the double disc, and yeah, it's great because the second disc has this feature-length documentary on Peckinpah called Man of Iron.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
I have a problem where, at one point or another, I owned a lot of Criterion DVDs. I have a problem where I get really excited about collecting, and then I say, what's all this crap doing in my house? And I go sell them.
I'm with you. I've done that too, man. In my
but
lifetime,
I've
sold some stuff.
I have owned so many of the Criterions, and my two all-time favorites are 8.5 and M, because they felt like real discoveries for me. But at the same time, I value Criterion most for their investment in all the Kurosawa films.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites.
Of course, and the Ozus.
Yeah, the Ozus, too, but the Kurosawa, without a doubt, Stray Dog and Yojimbo for me.
For sure.
Yeah, they're going to have his whole filmography pretty soon. They just released a small box set of his first, like, three or four films.
Yeah.
Right. And also Sam Fuller, all the stuff that they've done for Sam Fuller, you know, putting out
his
first movies and stuff. Yeah,
The Baron of Arizona.
Exactly.
So, Jerry, if you were to give, like, a couple of titles for your wish list for Criterion Treatment, what would they be?
Oh, God, for a wish list? The problem is they might already have made Out of the Past. I would definitely love to see a Criterion of Out of the Past. And let me see. Can you get back? I mean, they have to be old, or can they be new, or it doesn't matter?
There's not a criteria here, Jerry.
Okay. I'll give three.
You're not following the rules.
I never follow the rules. That's why I'm like, you know, I was put on the special bus. Out of the Past, All the Real Girls, Reservoir Dogs.
That's three right there.
And The Duelist. All right, four.
Okay, all right, four.
And the Fisher and Chris in the chat room said The Fisher King and 12 Monkeys. I would have to put 12 Monkeys in.
I love that you put All the Real Girls in there. What a great movie that
is. One of my all-time favorite films of the last decade.
I would agree with you on that, and I have an article on filmicability about it. Someone interviewed me about it, and I just love it. I think that's one of the great romantic movies of the past. Oh, I would say like of all time.
It's right up there, one of mine, without a doubt.
For sure.
Nobody wants to see Manos, The Hands of Fate on Criterion?
Yes, I do. Yes.
Only, I would, okay, so here, I'm going to, like, refer to that, okay? I would want, I'll pick four films. I would first want Chilly Scenes of Winter by Joan Micklyn Silver, which is a great movie from 1979 with John Hurd and Mary Beth Hurt and Peter Riegert, and also it was one of the last movies done by Gloria Graham.
Mm,
and yeah. It is a great movie. It's not out on DVD right now, and it has a very interesting history. It was the first movie that I chose to, like, review on my website after I gave my bio and everything. And it's just one of the great movies. Second would be A Little Romance, which is the most obscure movie in my top 10 movies of
the
all
Olivier
time.
The Olivier Diane Lane thing?
That's correct. With directed by George Roy Hill, which is also one of the greatest romantic movies of all time. Probably the greatest, I think, because it really gets into the details of what makes people connect. And it's beautifully shot and scored by Georges de Leroux, who won an Oscar for his score. And it's got a great script by Alan Burns, who was a James L. Brooks compadre during the Mary Tyler Moore years. Also, I would throw in there... they're doing Head now, so that's out. I would throw in there Sherman's March by Ross McKelvey, and that's one of the great documentaries of all time because it really gets before it's an essay movie, but it comes before any of the Michael Moore essay movies, and it's not political. It's about people. It's about himself, and it's a great 1986 movie that is just unbelievably brilliant.
Dean, I've seen it. It's great. Yeah.
Yeah, isn't it? It's a must.
It's one of my favorite documentaries ever. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, there's nothing like it. There's really nothing like it. He did a sequel, which I would like put in a second disc because I think they really belong together. He's done some other movies that are also, you know, in the same thing, but I really think his first two movies, not his first two movies, but I believe that Sherman's March and Time Indefinite, the sequel,
The sequel has leaves in the title?
No. Bright Leaves was very recent. The two movies that really belong together. His first movie his first big movie is Sherman's March, which tells the story of him trying to make a documentary about Sherman's March through the South. Well, yeah, I'm telling the people. I'm telling everybody out there. It tells the story of, like, him trying to make a film about Sherman's March through the South. But what ends up happening is that while he's trying to do this documentary, he starts falling in love with all these Southern women, and it really becomes a documentary about Southern women and what they bring to his life. And then in the second movie, which is Time Indefinite, he's married, and he's in the journey of marriage and all that stuff, whatever that brings, and there's losses in his family and so forth and so on. And he always has the camera running. He's brilliant. He's one of the great documentarians of all time. And then finally, I would throw in Best Boy by Ira Wall. He won a Oscar in 79 for directing this movie about his cousin, Philly, who was a 50-something-year-old mentally challenged guy who was still living with his almost 80-year-old parents. And the filmmaker, Ira Wall, convinced Philly's parents to try and provide him an independent life away from them so that when they passed away, which was impending, when they passed away, he would be supported by an independent life that he had already put together. So so I put Best Boy as fourth. So that's it.
I would like to see Last Tango. Actually, one of my favorite movies of the 70s is Scarecrow. You also have to consider what kind of materials are out there and resources are out there to fill the disc up, and I don't know that Scarecrow would have those. But Chris brings up something in the chat room that I really want to, that I'd really like to see a Criterion treatment on, and that's Badlands. What a great movie.
That'll be next for sure, now that Thin Red Line is coming out, and they already have Days of Heaven.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's got to be coming up, of course.
And I can't imagine how beautiful Days of Heaven looks on Blu-ray.
Oh yeah, it's
just
and how it bounds and everything, you know.
Wonderfully shot. I mean, that's like up there. If you took a poll among cinematographers, which it's been done, and we've read these polls on the air in the past, of like some of the greatest photographed films of all time, Days of Heaven is there. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. I think that I've seen Dave. It's funny because in Atlanta at one time, Days of Heaven at a local cinema, for some reason, this is so weird, but a local cinema down in Sandy Springs in Atlanta was showing Days of Heaven on the big screen in 35 millimeter for like 6 months.
Mm.
And I went down there numerous times, and I even donated to them as thanks a Days of Heaven poster that I had.
Oh, what am I saying? What am I saying? McCabe and Mrs. Miller on Criterion.
Yeah.
I'd love to see that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Even though Warren Beatty doesn't like the movie.
Why does he not like the movie?
He thinks he's still really pissed off because
country instead to be on Criterion.
He's still really pissed off because Altman didn't listen to his suggestions. See, Warren Beatty from the beginning was kind of, he wanted to be in charge, you know.
Yes, of course.
And Altman worked completely differently than Warren Beatty did,
mm-hmm.
and he felt that he was being misusing the sound. I mean, he said the first part of the film is so muddled you can't hear anything, and they came to blows about that. And it's even speculated that he shot him dying in the snow, covered in snow. He took so many takes of that just to get back at Warren Beatty.
Oh, really? Like a Hitchcock thing for Tippi Hedren, you know, like just throw the birds at Tippi Hedren until she got all fed up and everything?
Yeah. Yeah, they did not get along. And it's been a point of controversy. I mean, and Warren Beatty was actually interviewed for that Robert Altman book, and he gave a single quote about it and said, look, I like the movie. I think it was the beginning of it was poorly made, but, you know, I like the Leonard Cohen music. I thought that was brilliant. And it was a really brave, ballsy way that he photographed that movie phrase for it, but there's some kind of special exposure they put on the film to give it the special look that it has, and it was dangerous...
That fuzzy look, that sort of fuzzy...
Yeah.
They didn't just put gauze over the camera or something like that?
No,
you know,
It was a very ballsy move because if it wasn't done properly, there was no negative. So they would have ruined the film completely. So it was real touch and go.
Right.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and Robert Altman discovered it because I guess he was taking photographs. And he shot a photograph of his sweater over the previous photograph he took, and it gave him that kind of look. And
yeah.
He said he went to the DP Vilmos and said, "This is what I want." You know?
Wow!
And it's such a brilliant, ballsy, brilliant ballsy movie, and so beautifully haunting, and
right.
Leonard Cohen music and everything. And Leonard Cohen hated it when he first saw it.
He did.
He grew to love it as the years went by, and he felt terrible for criticizing it when it first came out.
I think it's one of the crowning achievements of Leonard Cohen's career, to tell you the truth. I think it's one of the things that's going to keep Leonard Cohen going on and on and on until history falls apart.
Yeah.
You know?
You don't think any of his albums will help him do that?
He also records records, yeah.
Yeah, he does. That shows Dean is a true movie geek, because everything's related to
Yeah, it's true. Of course,
you know, I think without that movie, Gimme Shelter, the Rolling Stones would be nowhere. They'd be nothing.
All right, enough. Enough already.
But that's a great movie.
So how about our guest?
Yes, our guest is Bruce Beresford.
No. I'm talking about on the phone.
Which, by the way, I forgot to mention this. Bruce Beresford deserves special recognition, if nothing else, because he directed Dan Aykroyd to an Oscar nomination. I mean, that's like
amazing.
The miracle worker, isn't it?
That is amazing.
He did the same year. I think he did Loose Cannon. So yeah,
he's the first SNL person to get an Oscar nomination. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, Bruce Beresford actually directed 6 different actors to Oscar-nominated performances, including Robert Duvall, Sissy Spacek, Tess Harper, Jessica Tandy, Morgan Freeman, and Dan Aykroyd.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I want to mention an early Bruce Beresford movie that I mentioned in the chat room just a little bit ago, but I really like when he was still in Australia doing Australian movies, he did a movie called Puberty Blues, which is basically about a coming-of-age movie like set on the beaches of Australia. That's really wonderful. And
yeah, 1981.
Might be hard to find, but it's really a good movie.
Mm-hmm. Is that your pick for the next Criterion you're hoping?
No, not next.
They should Breaker Morant, though, should be definitely.
Breaker Morant, yes. I would say that Breaker Morant is his greatest movie.
I agree with that.
Criterion's done a Peter Weir. They did Panic at Hanging Park, Picnic at Hanging Park.
Picnic at Hanging Rock and The Last Wave, so.
Hanging Rock, yeah.
And the next Peter Weir movie that should be on Criterion, Fearless.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what? That's one of my top, probably one of my top 5 favorite movies from the past 15 years or whenever it was released.
Great film.
I adore Fearless.
Movie that is. I mean, let's talk about Fearless for a little bit. What a lead performance by Dick.
Yes.
Unbelievable lead performance that goes through so many beats. So many permutations that it is ridiculous. It has danger to it. It has heartbreak to it. It has everything that you humor, everything that you want from a great performance. It's really, really something else. But the direction too is fantastic.
I'm going to share some secrets.
Go ahead.
Here's a secret I know about Fearless. Donovan, are you still with us, man? Are you falling asleep yet?
No. I would be listening off air or on. I'd prefer being on the air because then you could hear my laughs in the background.
No.
Yeah, we prefer too. I like to know that somebody's out there laughing.
And pipe up.
With us and not at us.
Fearless. Peter Weir and Rosie Perez did not get along. Rosie Perez was a horror show on that movie. Constant complaining,
really?
Constant whining and bitching. And Peter Weir, to his credit, was just so calming and collected every time that he dealt with her. You know, he never raised his voice or lost his temper. But behind the scenes, he was fuming about her and her ego trip. Afterwards, somebody asked her about it and asked him about working with her and said, I'll never work with her again. She's a terror. So it's odd that Rosie Perez, this is a big break for her, a big dramatic break, and maybe it's a sign of why she hasn't followed up on that as well as she should have, because she's just horrific to work with, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, does anybody know about what Rosie Perez actually had to say about the experience?
No, I mean, it got her an Oscar nomination, and so I'm sure she's not going to bad talk the experience in the face of an Oscar nomination. But
right.
As the years have gone by, no, I've never seen Rosie Perez really interviewed in recent years. You know,
I wonder what she had a problem with. What, maybe it was just too difficult a thing for her to do, but also at the same time, maybe that difficulty of doing the whole thing actually transformed and transmitted itself into the performance itself.
It was attitude. It was a prima donna actor.
Right.
And my point is that's disgusting to me when it's actually somebody famous, like and somebody really good and proven, like Jeff Bridges. But it's really disgusting to me when it's somebody that's getting their big shot and they should be, you know, kissing Peter Weir's feet and doing whatever the hell Peter Weir asks of them. I mean, Rosie Perez gives a great performance in the movie. It's not a question of that. It's just, you know, just it's a big break. And I hate it. Every time I see something like, remember that show Project Greenlight?
Yeah.
Of course.
These kids are given, I say kids, these younger people are given their big break. They're making their first big studio movie, and it's this incredible opportunity for them. And what do? One group of them in the first week say, well, if we don't get this, we're going to just walk off the movie. We're going to quit. And I'm screaming at the TV. I'm saying, you freaking moron. You don't want this badly enough.
That is so true. I mean, that's it right there.
It agitates
me.
Donovan, there's the Shia LaBeouf. The one where they were threatening to quit. It was the Shia LaBeouf. Yeah, it was the, I can't remember
Battle
the name
of Shaker Heights.
Right.
Yeah, okay, that was it.
And then the first one was Stolen Summer, and, you know, you had to like that guy. He was an endearing guy, and that was a folly. I mean, I've seen both of those movies. I've seen all the movies, actually.
Yeah.
Because the third season was the John Gulager. That was when it moved to Bravo, the horror movie.
The Feast.
Feast, which they've made several sequels to already.
Yeah, so, you know, those guys kind of made out there, did well. But, yeah, I know what you mean, though. You are screaming at the camera. This is the, you know, all of us would die for that chance, and these guys are like, you know, just like, dude, you've got a chance, and so many people want to be where you are right now.
And who doesn't have to compromise? I mean, I'm sure Spielberg has moments when he has to compromise. You know what makes Spielberg a great director? The fact that he thinks fast on his feet, and he can compromise and make it better.
Yeah.
That is the sign of a great director. That is the sign of a great director. And the thing is, too, they kind of enjoy that kind of stuff because that makes the movie more, I mean, if they watch it again, that makes the movie more exciting for them because it's something that they didn't think of.
Right.
Yeah. Double Walrus in the chat room saying, wasn't Madonna initially offered the Rosie Perez part? I don't know, and I'm not sure. Maybe that's in the trivia section of that movie Fearless on IMDb. But and Guy asks, can you get Project Greenlight on DVD? I actually found it at a used DVD store, which if you want some rarities like that, I guess there's Amazon, or if you have a used DVD store in your area, you know, people sell their old stuff. I found both the first two seasons there. I would watch them from beginning to end. They were addictive to me.
They're fascinating. They're fascinating, and they're fascinating documents of how people react to the opportunity to make a movie that is a sure thing.
There's Kitten Fist in the chat room. He's talking about Spielberg compromising. He says, yeah, Spielberg wanted Woody Allen for Munich, and he had a compromise, and he went with Eric Bana.
Way to go, Kitten Fist. That's hilarious.
That is good.
Wow. And then you hear stuff like Kubrick wanted Steve Martin for Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah, I mentioned that on Facebook. I mentioned that he wanted him because I was talking about like how great Steve Martin was, and I even surprised Matt Zoller's sites with that piece of trivia who's a great film writer, by the way.
Yes, he is. We had him on the show. Good guy.
Yeah, he's really good, and he was like, "Wow, I didn't know that." You know, that's a real piece of trivia right there. But just imagine what kind of movie that would have been with Steve Martin in it.
Yeah,
Kelly Long, then I guess I don't know, or Lily Tomlin, and
yeah. during the sex scenes, during the sex scenes, my eyes definitely would have been wide shut if Steve Martin were.
Well, luckily that character never appeared nude in the movie. So.
All right. Hey. I'm sorry, Donovan. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, do you think it would have been an Egyptian-themed orgy because of King Tut? And
one of the great, great numbers on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah,
for the
sure.
All-time great.
One of their crowning achievements, for sure.
Another bit of trivia, I think, was that Kubrick, the reason he named Tom Cruise's character's last name Harford, because he wanted Harrison Ford.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
I heard that too.
That would have been a very
I didn't know that one.
But this movie had been percolating in his brain for a long, long time.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he was just waiting for the right time.
Really, since the end of 2001, he really wanted to do it in 69, and he had had many arguments with his wife about it, like doing it, whether it should be in the maybe not.
Yeah, you're right.
But definite debates over whether that should have been done, which I think is an ironic statement. But that was something he really did always want to do, and in the end, he really thought it was his best movie, and I really do think it's not his best movie, but I would say it's in the top five.
You know what, though? Well, seeing that he only made five movies, that's quite a statement.
Well, 13. He did 13.
It's actually the most enjoyable Kubrick for me. It's the one that I'm most likely to go to the most.
Really?
Eyes Wide Shut. Yeah, yeah.
Why so?
I mean, because it's the one that I relate to more, and it's the one that I don't feel is filled with dead energy. I'm not a huge Kubrick fan.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Why would you say that? What holds you back from Kubrick?
Oh, man. We've been through this before, and I know everybody like rolls their eyes.
Just put it down in a one sentence synopsis here.
His movies are lifeless to me, and
really?
I don't think he has a great story sense.
Well, fair enough.
Yeah, that's a big argument.
I don't want to start a debate right now, but we need to. You should do a Kubrick appreciation show, even though
we did.
Oh, really? Well, you should.
We did a Eyes Wide Shut appreciation with his DP and one of his actresses, and then talked about his other movies.
Well, I know that, but what about going into detail or whatever. But, okay, fair enough.
We talked about it for an hour and a half, Dean. I don't know how much more detail.
I'm still going through the back catalog. I'm sorry.
From Kubrick to Hot Rod, let me say, I did post.
That's a funny movie, man. That's a great performance.
I finally watched Hot Rod. I tell you what, man. I laughed a lot in that movie. It was the completely random stuff that had no business being in the movie,
right?
Which is most of Hot Rod that made me laugh the hardest. And there are lines like this, who would consider writing this? Because he's a wannabe stunt person that's trying to raise money for his dying father's heart transplant.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
And so the radio announcer announcing the race, which is AM radio, by the way. They have exclusive rights.
Okay.
The radio announcer says, do you like stunts? How about terminally ill stepfathers? Well, if you answered yes to either one of those questions, you're in luck. I was like, who would ever consider writing that line? It's the most ridiculous. The movie's hysterical. I love Hot Rod. That's my mission. I'm not crazy about Kubrick films, but I love Hot Rod.
Bill Hader's really good in that movie. He's really funny in that.
I have to tell you, JB, hold on a second. I have to tell you that your recommendation of Hot Rod has made me want to watch the movie. So I'm going to watch it.
Oh, it's a fun movie, man.
I appreciate it. And comedies are something so specific because laughter is involuntary and, you know, we all have different kinds of senses of humor. It just struck me as very funny. Hey, Donovan.
Yes.
Donovan, your category is Marlon Brando.
Wow. Right.
What was his last meal?
It was like it was five fried chickens.
That's hard.
There were stories of Brando eating Big Macs and throwing the wrappers over his fence because his housekeeper was trying to keep him on a diet.
Yeah.
By the way, in 86 when I was here, no, it was in 89 when I was here. I was in New York City.
When you were on Planet Earth?
No. When I was in New York City in 89, and I heard that Brando was going to be filming. Hold on a minute. So Brando was going to be filming a movie, which was called The Freshman.
You mentioned this already.
On
14th
Street.
He got out of his car, and you saw the shocks go up.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Oh boy, that was insane. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I was like,
okay,
would
that
look like a wall coming out?
Would that build up, Donovan?
Real quick, does that mean that the rappers went over in Jack Nicholson's yard then?
They did. Yeah. Who the hell left the rappers on my front lawn?
Marlon.
It's so funny because Nicholson did an interview with Rolling Stone and last time with The Departed, because he goes back to them a lot for interviews, and they asked, you know, do you miss Marlon? He said, yeah, I can still see his house from my John.
Wow.
Apparently there's a window in his bathroom where he could see the, you know, the back of Marlon's house.
What does he have, like an outhouse with a moon cut in it?
I don't know. But essentially, every time Nicholson takes a shit, he thinks of Marlon. He misses Marlon.
Wow.
That's what I took that to mean.
That's what I got out of it.
What's the question?
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be crude. All right. Donovan, Marlon Brando is your category, and your question is, which movie saw his directorial debut?
I will tell you, and Dean, don't say anything, because I know he's an expert on old movies.
I'm quiet.
Okay, this is a movie that originally Kubrick was going to direct. It's a Western, and then Brando shook over for whatever reasons. Maybe Dean could give us a five-minute dissertation on that after. But it was One-Eyed Jacks.
All right, Donovan.
Good job.
You're on the board.
Great.
No dissertation needed.
You know what?
10-minute dissertation on Head filled your bill for that.
Yeah, hey, man, Head is a great movie. It needs to be a dissertation.
Jamie, what was that about ending the show early?
That's the only one I haven't seen in the...
it's been a long time since I've seen any Head. all right. Okay, Donovan, you're on the board with 1 point.
Yay.
We're only going to ask a couple of questions, then we'll get to our interview so we can end the show. To answer your question, Jerry.
No, I was
Dean. I know, Dean. Your category is potluck, number 32. If that makes a difference.
Brando's favorite meal.
It was a whole butt steak in there, and
oh, here's a good question, dude.
All right, go ahead.
Okay, Dean. Say you, say me. Won an Oscar when it was used in which movie?
White Knight. By Taylor Hackford.
You're right. 1-1. Donovan.
Yes.
Your category is, I'm trying to do the McLaughlin group. Your category is potluck. Your question is, for which film was Vincent Minnelli awarded his only Oscar?
As a director, right? Not a choreographer. Let's see. I'm thinking it's a musical, because he didn't win for his great dramas like Some Came Running. I'm just going to guess, because I don't know for sure. Meet Me in St. Louis.
Blues. That's what he should have won for.
And Dean, what did he win for?
An American in Paris.
Mm. No, you're both wrong. Wrong!
He won for Gigi. Oh, my God.
Gigi, yes.
Oh.
Which rhymes with another movie that will never win an Oscar.
George Stevens won the Oscar that year for American in Paris.
Yeah. Oh man. Okay.
That's like Hitchcock winning for Rebecca. It's like let's give it to him for, you know, Gigi.
Yeah. Exactly. Only Hitchcock never won a real Oscar, so.
Not a real one. He won one of those made out of chocolate, though.
He did, and he ate it. He ate it immediately after.
Yeah, he gave it to Marlon Brando, actually.
He bit the head off of it and then gave the rest of it to Marlon Brando.
1960 stars is your category, Dean. Your question is Pluto. No. Whose autobiography was called Baby Doll?
Carol Baker?
You're right. You're right.
Because she played Baby Doll.
That makes sense.
Have you ever seen Baby Doll?
No.
I did.
It's great.
It's very dated. It doesn't hold up. I just watched it a couple months ago for the first time.
It is dated, but she's great in it, and I like Eli Wallach in it a lot.
Oh, yeah.
That's why
I saw it, because of Eli Wallach, but it's very dated. Anyway, my turn for the question. It's 2-1, I think. Dean's up.
Yeah. All right, Donovan, here's your question. The category is musicals.
Oh, why am I getting two musicals in a row? What About My Voice says musical.
Which Mary Poppins song won the Academy Award?
Ooh.
I only know two of them, and I guess I'll just go with my best guess is the Spoonful of Sugar.
I know it, so.
Okay, Dean, what is it?
Chim Chim Cheree.
Very good. Very good.
My second guess.
Chim Chim Cheree. Dean, your category is partnerships. And your question is, that's too easy.
Ask me another Action Jackson question. That's the one I lost on last time.
You really that really is in the movie trivia guide book.
Action Jackson, yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
right above Leonard Six, multiple choice.
Of course. You can understand why I missed that one, by the way.
Yeah.
Which tough guy played opposite Jill Ireland 12 times?
Well, it was her husband, Charles Bronson.
Very good.
Yeah, I get musicals and he gets Charles Bronson.
Yeah, he gets Charles Bronson. What kind of upside down world is this, man?
By the way, the movie the British film Bronson, brilliant. You guys see?
Yeah, I like that film. Thank you.
What a great movie! I mean, it wasn't necessarily a great movie, but it was a great performance and definitely something that I mean,
very
again,
interesting.
I've been saying for on the show that Tom Hardy is like a star.
All right. Well, he owes you 10% of all his royalties.
Who's the next question? It's Donovan, right?
Yeah.
All right, Donovan, here's your question.
Not a musical.
3-1.
It's actually 4-1.
Oh.
I think it's 3-1. No, I'll go with Dean.
All right.
Doesn't matter.
Donovan,
there's no way to catch up.
Which low-budget, well, there's no way to catch up because you're only playing to five. Which low-budget horror movie did Oliver Stone direct in 1981?
Ooh.
Oh, I know.
Is that the Crawling Hand?
He's close.
That's good enough.
It has the hand, right? Something like
yes.
That's it.
Okay.
All
good.
Right.
The movie is called It Has the Hand Right.
with Michael Caine.
Yes.
As an artist that loses his hand, and
yes.
And SCTV did a great spoof of
The
Hand.
Oh, God, I was just thinking of that. Okay,
you remember that?
Yes, I do. Oh, my God, this show's going to go on until 3 in the morning now.
Okay, Dean, your question is, who wrote the screenplay for Billy Bathgate?
Oh, I know this.
Wow, this is really this is a really sort of difficult one, actually.
You know this, Dean. I know you know this.
Well, I know Robert Benton directed the movie, right?
Yeah, he directed it. Yeah, that's right.
I mean, is it E.L. Doctorow or whatever? Is that who did it?
It's based on his book. Yes, I mean.
I
don't know.
Donovan, any idea?
I knew he was the author of the novel, so I was going to kind of guess on that. But I guess I'll say, because we've been talking about him earlier, Warren Beatty.
No.
Perfectionist.
Jerry, who is it?
No, it's Tom Stoppard.
Very good.
Oh, man. That was a difficult one. That's a level 4.
Yeah. Donovan, we haven't gotten a 5 yet. There's still hope.
Oh, excellent.
Here is your question, Donovan.
Okay.
Bound for Glory was about which star?
Well, yeah, which folk singer? Woody Guthrie.
Yes.
Good, that's really good.
An underrated movie. Whenever people talk about 1976 movies.
Wow, amazing. He's got like a 5-minute dissertation on
No. Because you talk about 1976 movies, and you got Rocky, Network, All the President's Men, and
Bound for Glory. And
we talked about that movie, too, last year.
We did a Hal Ashby tribute. All nominated for Best Oscar.
1976 was an incredible year. How did they pick it? I don't know.
It's 4-2 now, Dean.
It's 4-3 now.
Oh, 4-3. Perfect. All right. I have one chance to catch up.
Okay, Dean. This is to win the game or not.
Wow. All right.
Your category is headline makers, and your question is... Oh God, that's tough. I'm not gonna ask that. That's just
out. Go ahead.
No, I'll just tell you what this question is.
He's
which,
a level 5.
But I won't give you this question. But this is the kind of difficulty of this question. What suspect number did Hugh Grant have when he was arrested with Divine Brown on the Sunset Strip?
Oh, that's insane. That's not a movie question. That's a celebrity bullshit question.
Yeah.
Well, most of these in this category are. But here's the question. Whose marriage to Zsa Zsa Gabor lasted just 8 days?
That's another bullshit question. Zsa Zsa Gabor is in her last days, you know.
Yeah, she just has 8 days left.
She said that she wanted to go home from the hospital. She's 93, and she said she wanted to go to the hospital.
That is not the answer.
I'm gonna say I really don't know. I don't know anything about like celebrities' personal lives, really. I mean, just a little. But I would say I don't know Nikki Hilton. I don't know.
Nikki Hilton is the correct answer. No. Donovan, do you have any idea?
If I guess and I'm wrong, do I still get the next question? I mean,
yeah.
Ernest Borgnine.
No, it's Felipe D'Alba.
And what's the name of Felipe D'Alba?
That was Kate Smith that was married to Ernest Borgnine for 8 days.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
All right, Donovan. Who was the husband of the writer of the screenplay for E.T.?
Oh, I know that, but it's a very convoluted question.
I know.
Yeah,
it takes for... Yeah.
Who is it was... Okay, now, do you want the star or the actual...
I want the husband. I want the husband.
Oh, Harrison Ford.
Very
good. Good, very good.
Very good.
Okay. It's 4-4.
So this is like really, we're really right down to the thing, and it's this question. Oh, yeah.
Yes, we are.
This is Dean,
who wrote Wired about John Belushi?
Gosh. Do I know this?
Are you talking about the book Wired?
Yeah. Who wrote it? Yeah.
Oh, it was Bob Woodward.
Yeah.
All right. You've won the game.
Bing.
I have no celebratory sound effects.
Yeah,
I'm so sorry.
Man, you like Mike Tyson back in the day, Dean. I mean. And now we need to get like Evander Holyfield there.
When it comes to trivia, I'm pretty damn good, especially movie trivia. But
Our Donovan, I want you to call in when we do our. Well, you know, I don't know if we're going to do movie trivia. I think we've got a full round of Name That Film score next month with all the composers and stuff we've got set up. But call back anytime.
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying.
I enjoy talking to you guys.
Yeah,
and
likewise.
Have a great rest.
It's always good.
Yeah,
thanks,
have a great
Donovan.
Rest of the show. Yeah,
thanks,
Dean.
Thank you, buddy.
Take your hand over the internet.
The hand.
You don't know where his hand has been on the internet, so I'd be careful.
Very careful.
It's
I hope
all
you have,
over
like,
it.
I hope you have some wipes
the window
with you.
In New York City.
All right, buddy. Thank you, Donovan.
Okay. See you guys.
And Dean, we're gonna play. We're gonna play our interview. Close out
all
the
right,
show.
Sounds good. Sounds good. I'm looking forward to listening to it.
All right, buddy.
I like Bruce Beresford a lot. So, all right. So I'm out.
All right, buddy.
A little bit later.
Dean. Have a good night.
Thank you, Jerry. Thanks, Jamie. Bye.
Bye. All right, we're finally to our interview. That lasted a little longer than we thought it would.
Yeah.
That whole, you know, we just get on a roll. And
yeah, we do. It happens. It just happens.
Yeah. Bruce Beresford's new movie is called Mal's Last Dancer. And it actually opened, I believe, last year in some other parts of the world, including Australia, where it's a huge hit. And it opens in limited release here on Friday the 20th. And it's a very inspirational story about a gentleman that ran away from China to America and joined the Houston Dance Company and became a very celebrated dancer. And he came out with his autobiography, I think, like 2 years ago. And, you know, it's been said that anyone that really knows their stuff in dance, this his story is the stuff of legend.
Mm-hmm.
And the dancer's name... Excuse me. The dancer's name is Chongqing Li. Is his name, and I probably just massacred it.
No, you did better than I would. That's for sure. I would have, you know, someone would have said, "Hey, you know, what the hell did he just say?" At least the enunciation is better on your part than me. So.
Well, but it's a great movie, and it's very inspirational. Audiences are really embracing it. So check it out when it comes to a city near you. It opens Friday. I'm sure it would open in New York and L.A. and some other bigger markets. And open wider in the weeks to come. But here's Bruce Beresford talking about this new film and how he put it together, his difficulty of shooting in China, as well as some other experiences that he's had with actors like Robert Duvall in Tender Mercies. We had to ask him about that. So here is Bruce.
When they took me from my family, I did not recognize this as honor. I did not see dancing as an opportunity. Nor could I imagine how far I might go.
They remind me more of athletes than dancers. All except one.
I think I know who you mean.
Me! Welcome to Houston, home of the Oilers.
Fantastic.
I saw you dance.
You made it look so natural. That's because he is.
You have made us very proud tonight. Thank you. My father has $50 1 year. You spend $500 one day. I know this isn't your home, but right now it's the next best thing. I am this American girl. Make trouble.
No one has to know.
I'd like to say how exciting it's been having you here. You came as a student and leave here as a star.
I dance better here. Feel more free.
The request to have his stay extended has been refused.
I'm not going back to China because I love you.
Seeking political asylum means you'd have to defer.
Please worry about his family.
What is fair to Nation seem to return to China.
You got him, huh? What's going on?
If you do this, you can never go back home.
You're gonna put Lee on the front page of every newspaper in the world.
A Chinese puzzle is taking place in Houston.
My family, when I dance for them. They see the light that's there in front of you.
I'm curious how the material came to you, and what about the material did you respond to?
Well, I'd read, it's based, as you probably know, on Lee Schwinson's autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
And I read that when it came out, and I thought, oh my God, well, this is an absolutely wonderful story. But I never initially took it that seriously as a film, because I thought we'd never find anyone to play the main role.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I said to the Jane Scott, the producer, I said, you can't fake the dancing. I said, if you've got an actor, you could do, say you're making a boxing film, you could mm-hmm. probably teach him enough to make it work, you know. Or if you're doing even a, like a football movie. But I said, ballet dancing is something else. Mm. I said, they start doing this when they're like 6 years old. I said, you can't, no actor would ever be able to do it convincingly. I said, you've got to get a real ballet dancer. And is there a Chinese dancer who's a top-class dancer who we can use, who can also act and who speaks English and Mandarin? Well, she was determined. She said, oh, there must be, there must be. And well, she was very determined. And luckily, we found Chi Chow dancing with the Birmingham Royal Ballet in England.
So how extensive was that search before you happened upon Chi?
Fairly, we went to Hong Kong and looked at some dancers there, and they were pretty good dancers, but they didn't speak English with any degree of fluency. Mm-hmm. So that was a no-no. And then we came to San Francisco, but the only Chinese dancer there was a woman. Mm. She was superb, but that was no good to us. We needed a man. And then we went back to Australia, and then I got a call from Lee Schwinson, who'd written the book, who said, go to England and see Chi Chow. Who's, mm. He said, I believe he's very good indeed. So we went off there, yeah.
So had he had any previous acting experience?
No, none whatever. I mean, all the only acting he'd done, of course, had been on stage doing mm-hmm. ballet stuff. You know, there's some element of acting, but never done dialogue.
So tell me your work with him, because I would think that as a director, you have to modify your approach based upon the actor's needs. So how did his needs compare to the others?
Well, very quick. I mean, I said to him, look, you know, just underplay it. Be very straightforward, very simple. Just do the dialogue. We had to work out, because the tricky thing was to work out the progress of his English. Because when he arrived in America, he didn't speak English, just a couple of words.
Mm-hmm.
And yet after, you know, some time, he was quite fluent. And as we weren't shooting it in sequence, it was quite difficult working out how fluent he was in various places.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always quite worried about that. But then when I saw the film cut together, I thought we'd got it right.
Right.
Yeah, it was quite... And he did a very good job on that.
Oh, he's
exceptional. But of course, you see, he'd remembered what it was like when he was learning English. Because mm-hmm. when he first went to England to dance, he didn't speak any English at all.
Now, did you have any previous interest in dance? I mean, were you knowledgeable in that world?
No, I wasn't. In fact, I'd always been rather disparaging about ballet, I'm now ashamed to say. And I had to do a lot of research. I went to a lot of ballets, and I looked at a lot on DVD. And I read a lot of books about it. And then I got a, you know, I certainly began to admire it. I mean, the discipline involved is absolutely devastating.
Right.
I mean, the amount of training they have to do and the amount of exercises, even before they go on stage each day, they have to spend hours making their bodies supple enough to be able to work.
Mm.
The discipline is absolutely astonishing. And then I, you know, I realized, of course, that it's actually a very beautiful art form. It's really quite wonderful to watch.
Yeah, very much so. I'm curious, though, if in terms of the artistry of ballet and leaving an artist, if you empathize with that journey compared to your own journey as an artist, as a filmmaker? Did you see similarities there?
Well, it was much harder for him, of course, because, you know, I grew up in Australia and, you know, I always wanted to make films and, you know, I could sort of travel freely to England and America. I mean, he had the enormous drawback of being growing up in poverty under a communist dictatorship where people weren't allowed to travel. I mean, there was almost no obstacle that wasn't thrown in his path. And I think one of the things about doing the film, one of the inspiring things about doing it, was just watching how extraordinarily resourceful he was in overcoming all these things.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he had help from a couple of, you know, he had that one teacher who believed in him, who was a great help.
How closely did you work with him? I mean, the real-life counterpart, the one who's...
Oh, Leishman's in. Well, I went through the script with him very, very carefully, meticulously. I went and stayed with him in Melbourne, where he lives, and I went through it line by line and asked him questions about everything. And as a result of that, we added little bits and pieces, and I, you know, because I was able to say, how did this happen? How did that happen? What was this person like? What was that one like? And all that kind of thing. And he, you know, because he remembered everything. He's not, I mean, even now he's only 49. So it was a great advantage. And also he gave me an insight into Chinese culture, Chinese way of life, which, you know, I didn't really know much about.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about China, but following up on your collaboration with him, I would think that it's a little nerve-wracking. You know, you make your narrative fictional feature films, but do you feel an extra responsibility to get this right because it's based upon, you know, this man's life?
Oh, yes, I did. I mean, I felt that we really had to tell the story truly. you know, people have said to me that in the story where he broke up with the first wife, that he thought they all thought she'd come back and they'd get together. And I said, well, that, in fact, that never happened. I said, she went and that was it, and he married another girl. I said, I'm afraid that's the way it was. I mean,
yeah, that's life.
We didn't feel any compulsion to sort of romanticize it. I mean, it's probably a romantic story in any case, but we did tell it pretty honestly. I don't think there's nothing in it that's actually made up.
So tell me about the first time you showed the movie to him.
Oh, to Lee.
Yeah.
I don't think I was at that first screening. No, it was in Melbourne. They took a print to Melbourne and showed it to him, because I live in Sydney. And he rang me up and said he was delighted with it.
Good, good. And you shot in several locations. It's an international production. But
yeah, well, we shot all the Chinese stuff in China, but we shot all the interiors. The American interiors are all done in Australia. And,
okay.
And most of the exteriors were in Houston.
Huh. And tell me about the experience of shooting in China. Was that challenging?
It was a bit less challenging than I thought. I mean, the Chinese government people originally told us we had to remove all the scenes from the film with Madame Mao. And because she's a non-person, they said you can't show her. But we just went ahead and did it anyway. I thought they were going to turn up and stop us. But they never did. They never did. And I think they were distracted by the Olympic Games and all that kind of stuff that were coming up.
Yeah.
And we had a Chinese crew. So, you know, we were employing a lot of people. That could have been a factor.
Yeah. When you first started making movies, I mean, you've had such an incredible longevity. Your reasons for making movies now and what that does for you, is it different than when you started?
I don't think so. I mean, I always, you know, I read stories like this one and I get absolutely carried away and I think, oh, that's a story I've got to tell everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I get passionate about them. You know, there's a lot of other stories I've wanted to make that I've never been able to get finance for. You know, I've got a stack of scripts that I would just love to be able to direct, and I've never got the money. But on this one, which I was you know, a story I thought I had to tell. Luckily, through Jane Scott's efforts, we did get the money. So
right.
It's great to have been able to do it. I don't think I've ever really changed in that way. I mean, I have made films that I wasn't particularly keen on, but, you know, that was usually because there was things I wanted to do. I couldn't get off the ground, and I had to earn an income.
Well, if you haven't changed, I'm sure the industry around you has. I mean, do you find it harder to get something off the ground than it used to be?
Oh, yes, it's changed a hell of a lot in the last few years. Because I've had investors say to me, look, we can't invest in films because everybody watches them for nothing. So we can't get our money back. I mean, the kids download them and see them free. I mean, I even saw on a website last week, I was looking for something or other, and an ad came on and said, you can watch download Mao's Last Answer from this website and watch it free. But they're actually advertising. And, of course, you know, this puts investors off terribly. So they say, we don't want to put money in films when there's absolutely no chance of recoupment.
Do you feel that it's a different process when you're doing what you're doing now, kind of nurturing your baby towards an audience? Is that a different process for you now than it used to be?
Oh, I don't think that is. I mean, if you're actually making them, it's much the same.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you just hope that people will go to the theaters and see them because they look far better on a big screen than they do on an iPhone. Just hope that they'll go and see them there. You know?
That's true. I cannot imagine a world where we're relegated to watching Lords of Arabia on an iPhone.
No, well, I mean, my daughter, who's at college in California, watches movies on the phone. I said, how can you do it?
I don't understand
terrible.
It. You working with a first-time actor in this, it has to be different from working with the more seasoned actors that you've worked with in the past, like the Morgan Freemans and Robert Duvall.
Yes, although Chi was very, very quick on the uptake. I mean, he understood about the film process very fast.
Yeah.
And in a way, you know, it was quite easy because he very much did what I said. I said, look, if you do it like this and like that, it's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do it simply. Think yourself into the role. And he's very intelligent. And I said, you know, just do, you know, let me just guide you through this and just do what I say and we're going to be fine. And he did, and it was good. I mean, you know, sometimes you get professional actors who resist.
Yeah, absolutely.
They want to
do
something else. And you think,
do you find, though, that a big part of, and this isn't to belittle the director's role at all, but when you hire an actor like a Morgan Freeman or a Robert Duvall or I don't know, so many great actors you've worked with, that you tend to just want to kind of stay out of their way?
No, well, I don't think I do that. I mean, generally, I mean, those two actors you mentioned are particularly two of the greatest actors alive.
Yes.
I mean, you always know that what they're going to do is superb. But that doesn't prevent me from saying what I think. And also, of course, I think one of the things about directing a film, about directing a performance, is mm-hmm. making sure you photograph it in the right way. I mean, you can ruin a good performance by shooting it too close or too far away.
Right.
Or having the wrong lens on the camera. You've got to understand enough about film technique to be able to maximize the actor's performance.
Well, we spoke with Robert Duvall last week about his new film, and obviously Tender Mercies was a huge a film for him.
And he's unbelievably great in it, yeah.
Oh, he's breathtaking in it. Tell me, and that's a breathtaking movie, tell me about that experience.
Well, it was 30 years ago now. Mm. I mean, he was, I remember doing the very first shot with him. I mean, we'd rehearsed it a bit, but he doesn't really rehearse like a lot of professional actors. When you rehearse, he just kind of talks, you know, he doesn't really do it. And when we did the first shot, I think my hair stood up. It was so electrifyingly in character. I was absolutely stunned.
Wow.
Mac Dixie told me to bring that back to you myself. tell you it ain't no good. She told me to tell you even if it was good, she wouldn't sing it, and that she don't want to have nothing more to do with you.
Well, no, wait, I don't want anything to do with her either. I just wrote this song. I thought it was a good song for her. I guess I was wrong. Now, did you get a look at it?
Yeah, I looked at it.
Well, what do you think?
Well, I don't think it's no good either. It's a different game now.
Well, that's fine. I don't give a goddamn about any of this no more, so what in hell is wrong with me? God damn it!
I guess it's hearing about Sue Ann being blown up and all, being swarmed.
No, no, no. It's got to be hard on you not being able to see her. I love you, you know? And every night when I say my prayers and I thank the Lord for his blessings and his tender mercies to me, you and Sonny hit the list.
Thank you.
And you direct an opera as well, correct?
Yes, yes. I just did Streetcar Named Desire in Australia at the Sydney Opera House. And when I finish this film, I'm going back to do another American opera of Mice and Men.
Wow, wow. Tell me what kind of, what different set of muscles that exercises for you than making films.
Well, of course, you've got, with opera, you've got the amazing, you've got the tremendous emotionalism of the music. But as a director, you know, I have to really work it out so the audience is captivated by watching in a long shot. You know,
right.
They're sitting there in a fixed position. So I have to work it out in terms of the set, the groupings of the characters, the lighting, the movements. You know, you have to do those things on film as well, of course. But on film, you know, I carefully work out the lenses, the cutting pattern, the camera movements, all those factors as well. You know, I'll do a close-up here and I'll do a two-shot here and I'll use like a 30mm lens or a 300mm lens according to the emotional content. I'll vary it. But doing an opera, I'm well aware that everyone's watching in a wide shot. And so
right.
It's a different sort of discipline. You know, I'll work on the set very carefully and I'll work on the lighting very carefully. And I'll also direct the actors very carefully. You know, I mean, frequently with opera singers, I still say to them, look, don't try and overplay it. Keep
right.
it down. Don't feel that because the audience is some distance away that your body language has to be exaggerated because it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've said to them, look, body language is something we all read every day. And we can pick people's body language across the street.
Yeah,
and I
yeah.
said, you know, you can doubt, you know, you can. Modern opera singers tend to be much more au fait with all that than the older generation, who thought they had to be rather declamatory.
So you said that you're going back to direct of Mice and Men.
Yeah.
After your current film, and your current film is Peace, Love, and Misunderstanding.
That's right.
It?
Yeah, we're about 2/3 of the way through that. Yeah.
Jane Fonda.
Yes, Jane's in it. She's one.
Wow. Great. Before I let you go, I know that Mal's Last Dancer has it's been playing internationally. I know it's a great success in Australia, for instance. When you attend screenings, which I would imagine that you have, what do you find that the audience is taking away from it?
I think they get a tremendous sense of exhilaration from it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just the story is so inspiring. I think they walk out feeling almost on a kind of high, which is very gratifying.
I'm Elizabeth, by the way. Everyone calls me Liz.
Liz?
Yeah.
Like Lee. Everyone call me Lee.
Yeah, I know who you are.
Lee Chunxin.
Chunxin.
Mm.
That's really beautiful. What does it mean?
It means keep my innocent heart. You dance with company?
Oh, no. No, I was in the choir of Nutcracker once, but that's as close as I've come to getting a contract. This is my second time in the full-time program trying to get Ben to notice me.
OK. Okay, that's Bruce Beresford. The movie is Mao's Last Dancer, opening in limited release Friday, August 20th.
That was a really good interview. That was really cool.
Thank you. All right. Anything else?
No, dude, that's it. I think we've had a full plate tonight.
We'll be back Sunday night with composer Brian Tyler. A great conversation about, you know, what he does.
Yeah, it was great. It was good. Really good.
His feelings about other composers' works and that kind of thing. And then Wednesday night, a week from tonight, we'll be back with James Cameron.
The King of the World.
Yeah, the King of the World. And then the following Sunday, it'll be the star of the new film, The Last Exorcism, which is getting a lot of audience buzz. Like, if you go on Twitter and look up The Last Exorcism,
mm-hmm.
It's just covered with, my God, this is the scariest movie ever made kind of talk. So think it looks like it has potential to be one of those underground horror kind of phenomenons. I know it's angling itself to be.
It is. It's definitely trying to do that. So we'll have
in the Paranormal Activity vein, kind of.
Yeah.
And then we'll follow that up with a week of special shows on the works of Brian De Palma.
It's gonna be
stuff
insane.
Coming up. All right, buddy. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, and thanks to Dean and Donovan for calling in, and thanks to everyone for tuning in tonight.
I'm glad we can end the show 10 minutes early.
Yeah. All right.
All right, guys. See you next time.
All right, see you. Bye-bye.